This episode is brought to you in part by Patreon supporters. Thanks, guys. You can become a Blotter Presents tipster at patreon.com/blotterpresents. And we've got new polls and goals over there in the last week, so please check out the page if you haven't done so lately. And now on with the episode.
In regard to the camera, we are conducting the public's business, and we're going to do it in the sunshine. After all, this is Florida.
Joe Berlinger takes another run at Ted Bundy with Extremely Wicked, Shockingly Evil, and Vile, a project whose primary reason for existing may have been the stunt casting. And in 1996, a TV miniseries took another run at Truman Capote's In Cold Blood, and there's a pretty good reason. You've probably never heard of this CBS production starring Anthony Edwards and Eric Roberts as the killers. Your reason to keep listening today? Chubb Lund and I might save you 5 valuable hours for other, better true crime material in The Blotter Presents, episode 96. Welcome back to The Blotter Presents, a podcast examining the idea that while crime is bad, some of the stories about crime can be pretty good. Other stories about crime mean well? Here to discuss those distinctions is my guest, Jeb Lund. Welcome back, Jeb.
Thank you. It's a pleasure to be back, especially on a day when my son has been sent home from school for being such a menace at the school that I wonder if he's on the problem track to winding up somewhere in Kansas.
Oh, gosh.
In a Truman Capote feature.
I really don't think that's true unless the classroom hamster was involved. But enough about your serial killer triangle. Let's get into today's Most Wanted section. We are discussing Extremely Wicked, Shockingly Evil, and Vile, which the title is like a hassle, has been a hassle to me for some time now. But in case anyone has recently arrived from space, here is the case file. Ted Bundy was a very bad guy who murdered at least 30 people. Joe Berlinger is not a bad guy, but I, for one, question the wisdom of his putting out a second Ted Bundy project in the space of a year. This one, the scripted take on Bundy's longtime girlfriend Liz Kendall's out-of-print memoir. Extremely Twisted, Shockingly Evil et al. Has been the talk of the festival circuit for months and dropped last Friday on Netflix. It stars Zac Efron as Bundy, Lily Collins as Liz, and a cavalcade of other actors who one suspects thought this was going to rate with Fincher's Zodiac, including Terry Kinney, John Malkovich, Haley Joel Osment, and one of Berlinger's daughters as a Bundy groupie. We will get into it. Trust. I thought this was going to be, I don't know what I thought this was going to be, and I'm not entirely sure I know what this even is or who this is for. Jeb, A, were you looking forward to this at all? And B, what did you think of it overall?
I wasn't looking forward to it because I definitely have, I know this is a weird thing to say on The Blotter Presents, but I do have a kind of true crime fatigue. I think right now, I'm sure cyclically it will come back in a big way. And in fact, like at the end of watching the In Cold Blood adaptation that we were watching, it automatically algorithmically recommended an Emily Watson and Dominic West true crime thing from like 8 years ago. And I went, oh yeah. I'm on that. You know? And I was so excited, but yeah, going in, I just kind of, maybe it's the Florida connection because, the Bundy execution, the Bundy capture, which happened in Pensacola, which was like 40 minutes away from where I went to high school, never really disappeared from the public consciousness. So you would get a lot of that kind of, you would get your annual piece in the newspaper about, oh, it's, you know, the anniversary of whatever. And, so maybe I was a little tired. I actually, I think it wound up being strangely inert in ways that I didn't expect, but I thought, and maybe this is just my trying to cobble together kind of like a woke take, maybe at the expense of what they were trying to do. I thought that there was something way more thoughtful going on with it than at the end than I did going in. Like, You know, it's hard not to be fascinated by these people who are awful, and very rarely, if ever, do we witness the way that they cut through the populace in terms of the people closest to them. And so, like, as a meditation on, let's say, toxic masculinity, watching the way that Ted Bundy just devoured the people around him who weren't murdered by him, right, but who were his victims nonetheless,
yeah,
was, I thought, a thoughtful way of doing it. And if I don't know if maybe they did, maybe they didn't lean on that enough successfully for you. I think they probably could have done a little bit more and kind of emphasized that. But like, as a tonal way of doing it, I thought that was thoughtful. And because like Bundy himself almost is like a cipher in the story, which is fitting because, right, like as a true psychopath, there wasn't really much to his core other than that malice and psychopathy, mm-hmm. right? So you're seeing all the emotional freight of what happens when people believe a monster and what happens when they extend their faith and goodwill and caring toward a monster, and how does he exploit them, even if they're not literally his victims.
Yeah, absolutely. And I think that's absolutely what Berlinger was trying to do, especially basing this project so much on Liz's memoir. But I don't think that it quite succeeds. I should say that this is not an unenjoyable hour and 40 minutes. Like, it's competently built. This is not somebody who doesn't know what he's doing. And I think that Zac Efron's performance is really good. One interesting thing I noticed is that it's been a few years since I watched The Deliberate Stranger, but part of Mark Harmon's performance that I thought was really good is that he had this, I don't know how to describe it, but this like hop, skippity, like High School Musical, if you'll forgive the reference, way of like moving about. Like he had this blocking, like if he was sort of jogging to the notorious Volkswagen Bug, he did it in this very sort of jazzy way. There was something very, I don't like, very sort of like a high school quarterback slash theater kid about his blocking that I don't know if Zac Efron like studied The Deliberate Stranger or if this was really a thing. You did see it to an extent in you see it at the end of this, but it's also in the Bundy tapes, Berlinger's nonfiction look at the story, mm-hmm. that, you know, that scene where he's coming off the elevator and they're reading the indictment and he's doing this very dramatical response mm-hmm. to the district attorney. And that his trial was often this like farcical show by design, because, yeah. you know, whatever else you could say about Bundy, this is not a stupid person or like facsimile of a person. Unfortunately, this is the problem with Bundy, is that, first of all, the casting of Lily Collins is not as strong. And I think the point of view, if this is supposed to be from her point of view, that's extremely muddled here, because the dark star of Bundy's charisma, unfortunately, bends everything toward itself. Like, he just has that dark gravity. Mm-hmm. And Lily Collins is either not being directed in a way that lets her sort of register against that, or the story is not being told. It's like the movie almost can't resist doing certain things. Like, given how much Berlinger has talked about how this is supposed to be like not about Bundy's crimes, it's really a lot about him instead of being about her. And mm-hmm. I think it's a good idea to, if you're going to come at this subject or other famous cases like it, to focus on this kind of victim, for lack of a better term, and to focus on those effects and take that point of view, because it's a different story from the one we've already heard 500 times. But I don't think this ends up doing that effectively because it's like it can't resist like all the other garbage around Bundy. And it just doesn't quite work for me on that basis. Again, it's not boring. It's not bad. I just don't think it quite does what it sets out to do, because once again, Bundy's existence perverts the whole prospect.
Yeah, I see that. I'm sorry, I didn't mean to cut you off.
I mean, there are some other issues with it. The production design is flawless, I will say that. Even Efron's wigs are pretty good, I felt. And he's very good, but this is the problem. Like, once you try to subtract Bundy from the story of his victims, you have to like really commit and do that 100%. And I also kind of don't feel like this is true enough to what actually happened and her actual suspicions and the timeline along which they occurred, because the fact is, like, psychopaths fool people by lying. And that's, I mean, there's not really that much to it. There's a pattern recognition that those of us who are not sociopaths use to make sense of the world. And when things about Ted Bundy didn't make sense, Liz Kendall just kind of filled in appropriate behavior in the spaces that she's like, well, I would never be dating a serial killer. So there's also some, like, the music cues are extremely on the nose, and I would have had a word with the music coordinator. Yeah. But there's also a scene where they're considering adopting a dog.
Mm-hmm.
Here is clip two.
Know about that dog? He's so sweet. Look at him.
We're gonna get a dog one day. Don't worry.
What will it be like? You're so weird.
Yeah, I mean, there's an example of the music cueing being a little much. And then the dog is like rage, like barking and raging, and then it is cowed by Bundy, who is not blinking. Like, I understand what you were trying to do. I understand why you thought it needed doing. It still should have been cut.
Yeah, it's like the scene where everybody figures out that the house is haunted because the dog can see the ghost.
Yes.
And then that's the first clue.
Mm-hmm.
You're like, yeah.
Yeah, I was going to go with an Omen reference, but yes, same basic principle. But yeah, Efron, I think is very good. He has this one scene where I think this is supposed to stand in for a lot of conversations that they've probably had, where she goes to visit him in, I think he's in Utah at this time. Could also be Colorado.
Yeah, it's not... The movie relies on, like, you're having seen the whole documentary and you knowing all this stuff back and forward. And see, you become sort of unmoored in time and place. And once you don't have that causation, the idea that he's sort of effortlessly wearing on her from all points around the compass and all points on the timeline, it's like, I'm not seeing it. You're not showing it to me. And, you know, now that I don't know where I am, I also don't know where I am in, like, the narrative point that you're making. I think that's one of the weird things about it. I'm sorry. I just, like,
yeah, no, not at all.
There.
I think that, sort of shifting back and forth, like, in geography and time, is a good idea. If this is your angle, is to sort of take her point of view, but it can be a little distracting, given that other ways in which the movie is trying to take her point of view don't entirely work. And I think there is a through line in this narrative of their relationship that didn't necessarily exist in real life after he left for law school, blah, blah, blah. But I cut the following clip as an example of Efron really selling Bundy's not only ability to convince, but his desperate need to convince her mm-hmm. and sell himself as a fully functioning human being. Here's clip three.
I'm going to take this all the way to the Supreme Court.
They're not giving you probation. They're giving you 15 years.
That's a maximum. That's a maximum. Okay, no one gets a max on the first conviction.
And you're facing 90 more for running.
I have this under control, Liz. I have it figured out. It's all up here, okay?
I can't do this anymore, Ted.
What are you talking about, Liz? Liz, look at me. Liz, look at me. Do you not love me anymore?
No, I do. I do, and that's the problem.
What if I get out? I can get out of here. I know I can. And we could go away. We could go away to Canada. We could do whatever we want to do. I promise. We'd be free. It would be fine.
Yeah. I'm not sure if he said it would be fine or it would be fun.
Yeah, me either, actually.
But yeah, I thought this was a good good exemplar of his performance, which is good. He doesn't overplay it. I think it's very tempting to kind of stress either how very like blandly likable he could be or how very like chillingly evil he was capable of looking and how he was sometimes able to present that way. Like occasionally you get a photo of him that's like, it's very obvious that something is not right with that guy, but then that could be confirmation bias. Like there's a couple photos that you're like the eye teeth are glinting and you're like, ooh. But that clip also put me in mind of the fact that there are times, and this is not only Berlinger who is suffering from this, but any narrative about Bundy, unfortunately, the stories of his escapes are pretty interesting. Like they're pretty compelling that he was able mm-hmm. to do that repeatedly. I mean, it's an issue. And that clip just put me in mind of like, there is a fair amount of time spent on him like cooking up his escape plan and hopping out the courthouse window and off he goes, and then later off he goes through a you know, ductwork above his cell. And it's like, I'm not someone who is necessarily super sensitive about, quote, glorifying this guy, because I don't think that's what fuels 95% of people's interest in his case at this point. But unfortunately, here again, Berlinger finds himself kind of sucked into the charismatic orbit of Bundy's misdeeds. And I'm just not sure this is what Berlinger thought he made or set out to make.
I think it was really hard. I think it would have been really hard for anybody not to include them because it's such a great set piece.
Yeah, and, exactly.
I mean, if you look at like the narrative slope, I mean, because that's kind of what it is for this movie. It's one woman who should not be believing this guy gradually coming to stop believing in him mm-hmm. as she learns things that we all already know to the point of maybe exhaustion. So like there's not a lot of like galvanic action or kineticism to it. Yeah. It's a lot of conversations and like dawning realizations. And so like, I think he just felt, I got to put this in there because it gives a beat to the plot. But from like an informational standpoint, and especially if you're trying to eschew making him seem cool, this could have been done with file footage from, you know, NBC from the time.
Yeah.
On like how he escaped, and you could be done with it in 30 seconds.
Which is relied on fairly heavily in this movie. There is a fair amount of not found footage, but like actual news broadcasts about his various escapes, when they apprehended him, the circus surrounding his numerous like near misses before his execution. Did you feel any kind of way about those? It did seem like Berlinger was maybe kind of trying to recycle some materials from the documentary. There was a lot of like voiceover narration of news to locate us in the story that I wasn't sure where it felt a little lazy. I just was wondering if you felt that.
I'm not sure it felt lazy to me. It felt weird that we suddenly, once he was in a fixed position, right, in a like Tallahassee penitentiary,
right,
we suddenly got all this anchoring and this insistence on grounding the audience and where we were both in the timeline and physically where we didn't before. And so at the beginning, and like maybe that works a little bit to the effect of like having him be hypnotic. It almost seems like kind of Twilight in the first, you know, third of the movie where you're not really sure where you're flowing to and from. And then all of a sudden, like we're having it reified, like this guy is still in the same spot. And I was like, all right, well, maybe that, you know, maybe we could have used more of the news footage at the beginning. And then now once we know where we are, we could use less. Although I did like hearing Tom Brokaw.
I was just thinking Tom Brokaw, like, oh, well, now we know where we are. Like, you know, America's knowledgeable uncle has just reminded us where we are. Yeah, that's a good point that, the movie may have been trying to underline the idea that even the trial judge, I think, was not maybe attracted is the right word, like not ensorcelled, but you know what I mean, like that Ted was a showman and this judge sort of not fell under the spell, because I don't think there was any suggestion that the judge was favoring him in any way or anything like that. But, you know, it's like one of the first televised trials. Mm-hmm. And I mean, it's interesting that if this film is supposed to be based on Liz's book and rooted in Liz's understanding of the case, that this much of it would take place in Florida and concern itself with that trial. But yeah, let's hear a clip of Malkovich-ing.
Dr. Suvram, is there any way to test whether those teeth will make the same marks over and over?
Yes. I took models of the defendant's teeth, and I went to the morgue, and I pressed those models into the buttocks area of different individuals, and yes, they do match.
I'm sorry, Dr. Suran, you did this experiment on cadavers?
Well, I couldn't find any live volunteers.
I have to question the competency of this expert witness.
Your Honor, I question the competency of this entire trial. This is a farce.
Oh. Dr. Suran, on that, we could not agree more.
Feel duty bound to remind you in the gallery that you were not on spring break. You are not waiting for the Flipper and Friends show at SeaWorld. It is a capital murder case.
I will splash the pot, however, I please. Sorry, just there are some the honorable Teddy KGB moments in this performance. But bless his heart, he came dressed to play.
Bless his heart.
But yeah, I just, you know, he doesn't fall into the trap of doing a like straight imitation of this judge, which, good, smart move.
Yeah.
But the film, this is another place where the film can't seem to resist Bundy's show. And it does make it muddled again as to what it's really trying to do. Like, all of this stuff happened, but it's more a testimony to Bundy's continued ability to manipulate almost everyone around him and to, you know, need to be the center of attention in order to fill a hole at his core that can't be filled. And I mean, again, this is not just a Berlinger problem, and I'm not being judgy about it. I just, I don't know if we need to do this again, honestly, despite the fact that it's a strong performance from Efron. Like, I'm not going to tell anyone that this is bad, but I'm not necessarily going to recommend it either. I'm just not sure what it's trying to do.
Yeah, the judge's compliment, I always read that both in real life and I guess like from a dramaturgical standpoint, like that's the most shaming and cutting thing he can say, is like, I can tell from your antics that you wanted to be taken seriously as a smart person. You could have been one.
Yeah.
If you weren't you.
Yeah.
Like, you know, you were trying to show that you could have been a trial attorney on the biggest stage in the country, and you proved it, but you could only prove it after being, you know, a monster.
On trial for murdering a 12-year-old.
I was thinking a lot about, before we started watching this, I was thinking a lot about The Silence of the Lambs. And then after I watched this, I was thinking a lot about that, of like, at least in the fictional tale, we're not trying to like revive. I mean, obviously, like, you know, Lecter and what's his name? Jamie Gum are based on like Ed Gein and et cetera.
Yeah.
But like, we're creating our own myth for the sake of commentary. Whereas in this, we're like, we're working with the myth that was given to us by one of the worst people in the world and trying to like create a redemptive like arc, and not redemptive for him, but like, you know, socially redemptive, and at least explaining how we could learn from this in a helpful way. And like, I think the source material does that really well. Like, the documentary is fine. I don't know what the biopic adds to it. And then the fact, as you say, like, it, as we focus on Florida, but we're still sort of tethered to this other woman back in Seattle, we lose the narrative heft that we should have from that, which, you know, again, is like, I still think the way in which these people destroy the lives around them, not just of their victims, because they're part, you know, they've internalized, you know, like the way to exploit the system, mm-hmm. you know, like the general decency of people. And actually, you know, you were talking about that earlier, about like the Mark Harmon thing of his gait when doing this performance, and like seeing Bundy live. Yeah, like, people who don't know how to adapt to like normal social situations because they don't feel empathy do wind up sometimes having that like performative cast to their body, mm-hmm. and positioning. Like, you know, like you said, on stage is like almost musical theater. It's like, this is what a person resembles when they feel this.
Yeah.
And like, and that is helpful in like, in preying on the people around you that you keep alive. But like, the fact that his interacting with a judge and doesn't really advance that. Like, in fact, the judge sees through him. So, you know, and we see through them. So like, what, why are we getting that extra confirmation, I guess, from the script when we should be doing it on our own? I don't know.
Yeah.
I'm all over the place too. Maybe that's the problem.
Yeah, no, I agree. I absolutely think that this script means well, but there may be some efforts to not like hit the highlights or sort of list the headlines or anything like that, but just to sort of touch base with things that we all understand or think we understand about the, you know, historical Bundy, and to underline that he was extremely charming and he was a showman, and so that we shouldn't blame Liz, who is our ostensible protagonist, for choosing to believe him. But A, in 2019, I don't think anyone does that. B, she's not a strong enough protagonist, and I'm not sure if that's the script or the casting or a combination, because like I said, like, Bundy's gravitational pull is extremely strong, like it or not. And then at the end, they kind of try to put a point on it, and I'm not exactly sure what the point is. Like, here, this is the movie in a nutshell, the clip that we're about to hear. He's about to be executed, and he gets a stay, and she comes to visit him because I think throughout this entire process over like 15 years, like, this keeps getting dredged up for her. Like, she keeps getting put through it by the media and her own guilt and everything else for a decade and a half. So in the movie, she goes to see him and she's like, I need you to admit that you did these things. Like, if, you know, You need to tell me the truth. You owe me that. So in this clip, she is going to, you know, she's going to show him a crime scene photo and she's going to ask about the circumstances. And when we first see her do this, she's blocked and shot from behind and she slams it up against the glass. And then we cut around to Bundy POV so that we see the photo, which I think is like a big mistake, honestly. Let me play the clip so we have some context. Here's clip 5.
It took me over a decade to look at this photo. What happened to her head?
She was deposited in the woods. Then animals could have conceivably done something like
animals
that.
Animals don't do that.
I'm not a bad guy.
You need to release me, Ted. What happened to her head?
This is kind of every bad decision that the movie makes. Lily Collins' line readings, I think, are a little kitschy. That they showed the photo, which, by the way, not only is the body headless, it is also topless. Who is that for? Don't do that. Let us imagine it via dialogue. And once again, it's overly... It's not trying to get us to side with Bundy, but it's just a little bit too interested in his, like, either feelings or attempts to replicate or reflect feelings so that he can keep her on the hook or what, like, whatever's going on here for him. This movie isn't supposed to be about what's going on for him. It's supposed to be what's going on for her.
So, like, first of all, I think I remember seeing comments when this was coming out, people going like, oh my God, are we going to do another thing where it's, you know, exploiting violence against women and exploiting, you know, their depersonalization and like abuse. And like this movie did a really good job. You see one violent act against a woman, like pretty much at the end.
Yeah.
Everything up until then, you know, like there's virtually none until once you get to the trial scene when they're describing the things he's done to bodies is so much more powerful, I thought, than even the documentary I saw about him that, you know, also done by this guy. Right. Like because at that point it has been. You know, not necessarily, because we're not sitting there believing, like, oh, this is a case of mistaken identity. We're not sitting there right. thinking, like, they've got the wrong guy, right? But, like, it is still sort of sanitized, and it's a process of, like, evaluating personalities and, like, and the justice system and, circumstances of evidence. And then finally, when it's just laid out, like, how incredibly physically brutal he is, you go, like, hold on a minute. Like, at some point, there isn't a conversation that gets out of this. And so that's what I wanted to see from that confrontation. And I think that's where they wanted to go. But I agree with you that they did it all wrong. They shouldn't have shown the picture. Have her hold it up and then have a little bit of light coming through so you can kind of see through the back.
Yes.
And you can see that something horrific is there. But keep the camera only on him and then do a very, very long take where he's being suffocated by the camera's scrutiny and you're watching the adaptations as he keeps trying to put on a different face.
Yeah.
That gets him out of
yes.
it. And then the realization that like he can't find one. That's what it needed to be.
Yeah. And I think that Efron could have carried that shot.
Yeah. No, I mean, they got close to it.
Yeah.
I mean, like that vibe is there. It's like, but they open the door and they don't walk through it. Instead, they open it and they let all this other dumb stuff through, like the photo.
Yeah.
You know, or that what period happened period to period her period face kind of like reading.
Yeah.
Or head, rather.
Well, and it, yeah, some of the even the like little bits of the scripting, like animals don't do that. Like, well, an animal did do that. you're talking to him. He's finally about to explain to you exactly what happened. And then the back part of that scene where he breathes on the glass, and like, I thought that that was pretty well done. And that just made me wish, this is sort of a crazy thing to say, but I would like to see what Terrence Malick would do with her, with her. Because I think he could then be much more elliptical and kind of cut some of the, you know, brutality out of it, except how it was being felt by Liz, if that makes any sense.
Oh, so like put him under the scrutiny of the camera, but as soon as he starts writing, you reverse it, and then you're watching her kind of react as each letter gets written across the glass, and like it becomes obvious that like the word is going to turn out to be hacksaw.
Or and just there's no shoot, avoiding. Just shoot. Like, what would he do with this entire story? Never mind that one scene. I mean, it's possible that it would be, turgid mess. In fact, it's
probably
depending on how you feel about Terrence Malick, it's probable. But on the other hand, why can't I come up with the name? Sissy Spacek, Martin Sheen. It's like the Malick for people who hate Malick, actually.
Oh.
Why can't I remember the name of it? You know what I'm talking about.
Yeah, I don't like whenever I think of Terrence Malick, I just think of Jim Caviezel looking up through Jungle Canopy and talking about Jesus.
Yeah.
And I'm like, that's World War II to you? Get the fuck out.
Yeah. No, it's a problem. Or like, you know, Ben Affleck walking through waist-high corn and sort of fondling it for like 10 minutes. Like, thank you. At least I got popcorn. All right, I looked this up. It's Badlands. I don't know why I couldn't come up with that. But I'd be... And that is based on, not Starkweather, Carol Fugit?
Man, like, you can't look up part of it and then expect me to, like, ad-lib the answers to the other half. You got to look up both sides. I mean, if I didn't know it was Badlands.
an impressionable teenage girl from a dead-end town and her older greaser boyfriend... Oh, the past. Embark on a killing spree in the South Dakota Badlands. Perhaps the trivia section. Oh, Charlie Sheen and Emilio Estevez's feature film debut. That doesn't technically count as a crime. Yes, the film's plot and lead characters are based on Charles Starkweather and Carol Fugit. So it was seldom right and wrong again. He does have some experience with this kind of narrative. I would just have been interested to see what a more elliptical, less, a story that was trying to make something that is not entirely linear, it might have worked better. In any case, this is fine, but unsuccessful, I would say, net. Are you going to recommend this to anyone, or you're all set?
I would say, like, if you like true crime things, I would say check it out just to see the depth of what can be done with the genre in terms of expressing things for different groups outside of it. I mean, like, maybe this is me. Like, to me, the fascinating thing about serial killer things is not, like, how they got away with it or how the cops caught them. It's, like, how much they resemble, like, normal people in your life and behavior that is... perfectly normalized. I mean, I think like the best exploration of this, at least, you know, from a pop cultural success standpoint, is still American Psycho, where you're like, yeah, this is like the hero of the 80s. Mm-hmm. Well, you know, he's a psychopath. And like that dovetails nicely with, you know, research on the fact that psychopathy manifests in like no profession more than it does in like business CEO, you know?
Yeah.
So like, seeing the ways in which he integrates into a regular life and can work the levers of normal people to get them to sustain years of blindness to his actual behavior is, I think, like a way more evocative way of thinking about a subject like Ted Bundy that has been so covered for so long. Like if you insist on doing something, like I admire the fact that you're trying to do something that expands the way we look at it. And maybe, you know, like, if nothing else, kind of go back to your life and go, wait, why is it that I tolerate this behavior or this kind of like you know, these sorts of like serial killer adjacent whiffs of conduct. And like, how did that become okay to me? And like, maybe that's not something we need at all. Like, I don't know. I think if you're going to overthink something like this that has already been so overthought, like, this is a good way of doing it. So give it a shot.
I recently alerted both of us to the fact that this property existed. Here is the case file for In Cold Blood, 1996. In 1959, career criminals Dick Hickok and Perry Smith, thinking the prosperous Herb Clutter had a safe on his property, murdered Herb and his entire family. A few years later, Truman Capote published In Cold Blood, his, quote, nonfiction novel account of the case, and took his place as the George Washington on the Mount Rushmore of the true crime genre. In 1967, Richard Brooks adapted the story for the screen. In 1996, Jonathan Kaplan, the director of Unlawful Entry and The Accused, which might explain some of the more off-putting casting choices here, God, directed a two-part TV miniseries adaptation starring Anthony Mark Green Edwards as Hickok, Eric Celebrity Rehab Roberts as Smith, and Sam O'Neill, Troy, Frank the Front Desk Guy on ER Evans, and one of the rapists from The Accused as law enforcement, and Kevin, always a rapey cretin on SVU, Ty as Herb Clutter. I am obliged to recommend rereading the book instead, or watching Cold-Blooded, The Clutter Family Murders, which is a very affecting nonfiction reinvestigation of the case by one Joe Berlinger, or, you know, reading or watching just about anything else, because for various reasons, this project is, if you'll excuse the expression, dead on arrival. Did you watch this whole thing? Please say no.
I did. I watched the whole thing last night.
I'm sorry.
Because I felt like I didn't have enough to say about yeah, the Ted Bundy thing that was going to be new, you know, and it was just going to, you know. So I was like, okay, I gotta have something for this. This is one of the weirdest watching experiences I've ever had. It was like
extremely odd.
It was like being on ketamine. I mean, it is like everything is underwater. And partly that's like the sound design from the mid 90s, like TV. But it just sounds like your head has been wrapped in gauze and, you know, so you're looking and listening through that, just this incredibly soporific tone for something as horrendously violent as it was.
Yeah.
The flashbacks that are supposed to deepen things wind up being so strangely like inert and dreamlike that it didn't engender much pity. I just sort of thought, like, why are you padding this?
Yeah.
The cast is surreal. I mean, you're right. Like, Kevin Tai, who hasn't been the good guy in anything since Emergency, so like, yeah, that's 40 years, right? And you're supposed to think that he's the godly, decent guy. And then Anthony Edwards, like, there are some bits where,
Jesus,
there are some shots where, like, he absolutely nails that, like, I'm a bully and a killer because I'm basically like a sniveling creep.
Yeah.
Weakling. And he gets it just right, but like, you can't get past the fact that it's Goose.
Yeah.
You know, even because I think this is pre-Mark Green. I think he doesn't become Mark Green for like another year.
No, it's well into Mark Green. I think that was...
Really? I thought this was 93 and Mark Green and like ER came out in 94 or something.
This is 96.
Okay.
You're right that ER was 94. I mean, there's a bunch of problems here, starting with it's a miniseries for television. And there's... The way that this is made, it is really stretching. This is not something that needs 4 hours to be told, I don't feel. It is very predictable and linear in the way that it's told.
Mm-hmm.
There is a lot of... There are a lot of things that they can't say or show because it's the mid-90s on a network, specifically,
right,
the Old Folks Network. This clip is close to the beginning of the first episode, and this has nothing to do with the miniseries, really. But my grandmother used to sing us this hymn when we couldn't sleep. So that's happening. And then at the end of the clip, they're testing the hangman's drop in the corner, which is the Kansas Penitentiary's execution barn.
Barn, yeah.
Basically, so there's this him. There's the, for the cheap seats, slow pan across all of the Clutter family members, some of whom are like 29-year-olds who are playing 16-year-olds. And then there's the hangman drop. Here's clip six.
And he walks with me, and he talks with me, and he tells me I am his own, and the joy we share as we tarry there, none other has ever known.
My grandmother's performances could really have used a button like that one. Like, what are you doing? It was just really a lot. And then I was kind of like, wow, that's pretty dark for a CBS miniseries. And that promise was not lived up to. Another issue I had with it, which is, I think, a trap that a lot of accounts of this case fall into, is that you have to, in an audiovisual medium, pick one angle on what the relationship was between these two and stick with it. Like, you can't sort of give different accounts. I mean, you could, but then you're in Malick territory again. And the one they pick is... I mean, it's fine. There are hints of a more than colleagues relationship at times. Mm. There are hints that it is true. Like, I think most people believe now, like, conventional wisdom is that Perry killed everyone. And you do get occasional hints from Eric Roberts's performance in the like 30 total seconds when it's just quiet and he's just reading the lines, that he was capable of that and that there was a sort of dead area in him that allowed him to do that to this family. Mm-hmm. But mostly it's just like, I think what they're trying to say is that the relationship between the two of them created a third killing personality, which is, you know, not an unusual conclusion to draw about cases in which more than one person commits a murder, but it's CBS in 1996 and it's just not quite getting there. And also, we know because Truman Capote did it already.
Yeah, the hand holding and the calling each other honey, you know, a lot. Like, yeah. I was like, all right. But I mean, I thought the supposed incident where they were touching hands and one of them was weeping was supposedly fabricated by Capote too. So it was an artistic decision based on an artistic decision. So you weren't really wedded to that. And then like, poor Sam Neill, what a weird career that guy's had, right? Like, you know, he's in like Riley, Ace of Spies, amazing miniseries. And then he's in like, you know, a Cronenberg movie and some other good movie, like horror movies in the 80s. And then somewhere in the middle 90s, he's doing this shit. And then like 2 years later, he's in The Horse Whisperer.
Yeah.
You know, and like, and this was like 6 years off of being in Hunt for Red October. How did that happen?
And also he's in The Piano, right? So.
Yeah. Yeah. Like, you know, any good, and Children of the Revolution came out this year, I think, too.
Yeah.
The one where Stalin's son takes over Australia.
Oh, yeah.
Yeah, great. I mean, like, delightful movie. But yeah, so I don't know. But the FBI agent he's based on, like, followed all the wrong leads. So we didn't get any of that, which would have been, if you're going to do like 3 hours and change, that would have been a way more provocative thing to do.
Yeah.
Than just have him be like, well, I'm a G-man. I figured it out.
Including the daughter's boyfriend, Bobby Rupp, played by Ryan Reynolds.
Ryan Reynolds.
Yeah. I mean, yeah, there's Gwen Verdon is in this. Like, the, it's a lot casting wise. They threw everything at it that they had. I have a clip coming up with her in it that is disastrously bad. It's not really her fault. But first, I'm going to play a clip in which we spend quite a bit of time being reminded of the, like, criminal folksiness of these two. And these two actors appear to be in completely different scenes from one another. Here's clip seven.
You ever see a millionaire fry an electric chair?
Hell no.
There's two kinds of laws, baby. One for the rich and one for the poor. What do you mean I should wear an eye patch anyway?
Well, you're gonna have to hide that eye, Dickie, in case somebody recognizes you.
Ain't nobody gonna recognize us. No witnesses. Remember?
Black stockings. That's what we need. And like nuns wear. You can't recognize the man with a black stocking over his face. Black is foolproof.
One of you pick an accent and stick with it for four words in a row. You're getting paid. Figure it out. Oh, God. I mean, Edwards, they were not directed adequately. This is actually interesting casting. Like, I looked at it and I was like, yeah, that works. Like, I think Eric Roberts is maybe a little too tall for this part, but yeah, that could work. But they are just directed, like, there's no control over the accent and whether it's present or whether it's like 200% present. And then Roberts is doing this. As the movie goes on, the problems with the character's leg are becoming more and more pronounced. And it's just this very shticky, silent movie thing where I would absolutely bet American money that he refused to stop doing it when the cameras stopped and demanded to be addressed as Perry and drank a lot because he was like carrying the darkness of this murderer with him. Actors, he's more controlled than you would expect, but it's Eric Roberts, so that's saying almost nothing. What was your feeling about these two performances?
So what I used to do, you know, I paid for college for a couple of years with an acting scholarship. And whenever we had to do something, it was like a lot of American idiom, like an accent or like, you know, I was afeared, you know, stuff like that, that is not what you would say. And you would not have a normal cadence. Like, it was easy to memorize the words, but then you get so caught up in like how you were delivering them and like again, you know, or like whatever voice you were doing that it like. The words became, even no matter what kind of spin you were trying to put on them, like everything you were saying was performative. And we always used to do a thing where you would just like take all the chairs in the room or like the desks or something and just like rearrange the furniture and like try to act out the scene while like climbing around and doing really weird shit that took your brain out of it until you just repeated the words until they got natural. And it's like they didn't have, you know, I was having very similar reaction to you. It's like, where was the rehearsal process? Like, it almost feels like this is the first time these two have heard each other talk to each other. So there's no real give and take. And like, you know, if they'd done it a little bit longer, maybe their accents might have normalized. They might have found a happy medium between them. But yeah, it just seems like they just learned the words and they're just getting used to making their mouth form the shapes that make the words come out afeared again, and they don't have any time to make their body
chair.
Like they didn't have time to like put the emotional shape around it. They just got the sound, and then that was it. I mean, it really does feel like almost like a table read at times.
Yeah, that's a good point. I don't think that Anthony Edwards is incapable of doing this part, but it might have been better if he had had more time. One does wonder, given that ER was underway at this point, if he just sort of crammed this shoot in during like a holiday break from the ER set. Hard to say. The accent is bad and the direction is bad, and Eric Roberts is given a lot of like crawling on the floor and writhing around and fetal position, like having nightmaresing to do, that he's, you know, that is what Eric Roberts was made to do, and he does the hell out of it, but it just takes so long. And there are scenes that are like, if you cut out every scene that kind of doesn't move things along, or seems like, well, you know, we all know all this. This is like now a part of American history that is like in everyone's DNA at this point. Like maybe I'm oversubscribing that part of it, but it does kind of seem like if this is based on In Cold Blood and you called it In Cold Blood, how is Truman Capote not even a character in this movie? Mm-hmm. Like he's.
Oh, you think he should have done it, or
no? Well, that would have been a neat trick. Sure. Light some white candles and let's get this done with automatic writing. Cast him.
Great if he had to do it as like Lionel Twain, though, right? Like he in character as Lionel Twain. I'm sorry, I just want to bring it back to Murder by Death if I could. I'm done.
Oh, you're the one who wants to bring it back to Murder by Death. I've actually never seen that.
Oh my God. I can't believe you have go watch that immediately.
Okay. Yeah. And we're back. I just find it strange, maybe because I have seen Capote and I've seen Infamous and I've, you know, read the Capote oral history and all that stuff. Like I just feel like it's very strange that he's not in it, but he might be one of those, you know, figures that exerts a gravitational pull also. So, or the estate wouldn't agree to it. Apparently the estate had no problem with extended scenes involving Gwen Verdon playing a woman who apparently has been dropped on her head, reorienting viewers who did not see the first night of the miniseries. Here's clip 8.
Bess, for heaven's sakes, who was that?
Mabel over at the paper. Herb Clutter used to be rushing around like a chicken without his head. Trying to make everything run as good as that outfit of his. Won't be rushing around anymore.
What do you mean he won't be rushing around anymore?
Because he's dead.
Oh.
It was Bonnie and Nancy and the boy.
Kenyon?
Somebody shot him.
Oh, good Lord. Do they know
who? Who did it? Who the hell knows? Somebody up that street, down that road. One of their neighbors, more than likely. Neighbors are varmints anyway. Always trying to slam their door in your face.
Oh, Miss Hartman, I am truly ashamed to hear you talk that way.
There's your episode title. Neighbors are varmints anyway.
Everything about that is, it just says community theater adaptation for, again, people who recently arrived from space. I just don't know who the scene is for. Like, even if didn't they do previouslys? It was 96, not 1896. Like, come on. Previously, this family was brutally murdered.
I think maybe the point was like to underline that this was the beginning of the disintegration of small town America, right? Like, you know, the town where this happened, which I always forget the name, Holcomb, right? Like the, you know, within decades, like the idea of all community fabric and like trust had just been ripped away. And, you know, this is the dawning of, you know, the back half of 20th century America. But yeah, you're right. Like it's incredible expository dump, and then also it's like it's an expository dump premised on the fact that a woman who lives in a town with like 12 people in it is downtown at the place where everyone hangs out, and it's like, a quadruple murder? Say what now?
Yeah.
I mean, like, somebody selling Bibles would have come to her door by now and been like, did you hear about the quadruple murder? You know?
Yeah.
This is a... I mean, I didn't go to a...
Very... I guess he won't be rushing around no more. What is that supposed to mean? It means that he's not going to be rushing around anymore. He's dead. Oh, my gosh. Okay.
She's dunking on the victim and his family like a day later. It's like, well, Mr. Hoity-toity, he used to have such a big head on his shoulders, but not after the shotgun took care of it.
Yeah.
Christ.
Can't rush around when you're dead. Okay. Thank you. Oh, yeah. I feel very, very sorry for Gwen Verdon in this role. How dare you? Like, she's put in the position of just letting this exposition pour over her like maple syrup. Our final clip is yet more inadvertent, inappropriate humor, which also points up the sad fact that in this particular production, some of the processy aspects of Dick Hickok's check kiting scams were the most interesting part of the story.
You know what I don't understand, Dick? Why these people accept your checks? What's the secret?
The secret is people are dumb. That's the secret.
Yep. Can't argue with that. All right. Well, yeah, In Cold Blood. No thanks on the 96. The movie's pretty good. It's considered a classic. Kind of a like weird footnotey thing given what Robert Blake got up to later in his life. But it's decent. The book, of course, is a stone classic. And Cold-Blooded, The Clutter Family Murders by Joe Berlinger, I believe, is available on iTunes. And you can probably find that just sort of paging through the internet. But I think it aired on Investigation Discovery last year. We did talk about it in episode 39. I talked about it with Mark Blankenship, so you can go back into the Blotter Presents archives and look for that. But In Cold Blood 96, All right, here's some stuff you should check out. Jeb, plug your shit. Where else can listeners find you and your works and days?
I have a podcast with David J. Roth of Deadspin where we watch Hallmark movies. It's called Dave and Jeb Aren't Mean. And the idea is we take the universe on its level and at face value. And we try not to do the how did this get made unnecessarily like cruel mocking thing. But they are deeply surreal. It's like getting into just a bathtub full of taffy as an adult.
Checks out.
Yeah, and we like the last one, I think in the last 3 weeks, we've watched one that was like terrific, one that was probably the worst we've ever seen, and then one that is like an exact, the exact experience you expect from very mediocre Hallmark. So if you check out the last three, you'll get a really good sampler of like just how well this can go and just how badly this can go.
Mm. And if you go back in those archives, you can find me and my work wife, Tara Ariano, talking about various... Wedding March is.
Yes, we've watched three. The Wedding March 1, The Wedding March 2, Resorting to Love, and The Wedding March 3, some other ominous subtitle. There's still, I think, two more. There's one that's already been filmed. I think there's one coming. Another new one. So we've got two more to do. And then Tara was also on an early episode when we were still just on Patreon, where we watched Mrs. Miracle, which starred Doris Roberts and James Vanderbeek.
Oh, yeah. Okay.
And so there's like, if you enjoy Tara just like dunking on Dawson, there and also like children that are suspiciously like hellish, but also fighting their angel housekeeper, there you go.
Sure. Well, Jeb, thank you very much for coming back on the show. And when the inevitable Lifetime movie is made about former Hallmark staple Lori Loughlin's various college bribery misdeeds, I hope that you will come back to discuss that. She should really play herself. I am not a crackpot.
There might be a conflict because I am auditioning for the role of Massimo Giannulli. So hopefully, I'm crossing my fingers.
Okay, well,
this could be it.
Then consider this my bid to lock up that exclusive interview. Got a tip for the Blotter Presents? Find me on social media. That's Blotter Presents on Facebook, Twitter, and Instagram. Or you can email me at bunting@the-blotter.com. You can become an official Blotter Tipster at the Blotter's Patreon page at patreon.com/blotterpresents. If you like the podcast, please tell a friend and rate it on iTunes so other listeners can find it. If you don't like the podcast, don't tell a soul. My guest has been Jeb Lund, and he is on Twitter at Mobute, M-O-B-U-T-E. I'm Sarah D. Bunting, and I confidentially inform you that I hope you'll tune in next time.